from Triple E Media. I'm still Ramat Mohammed, and this is still the backstory, but it's a mini episode. John, there was a football match a few weeks ago in Abuja. It was the Ghana versus Nigeria game, and Nigeria lost.
Yes, it was pretty tough, actually. Things got a bit out of control after the match. First of all, the stadium itself was filled beyond capacity. The game started at 6 p.m., and I got there 10 minutes after 6. By then, Ghana had already scored a goal. I didn't see the goal, but I heard the noise. I found out later that it was some fluke shots that went through the goalkeeper. Anyway, when I finally got into the stadium, the place was packed. Technically, the stadium is supposed to seat 60,000 people, but that place had at least twice as many people. It was mostly standing room that was left. No one checked my ticket when I entered the stadium, and I don't think everyone there had a ticket. There was no security check. Honestly, no one was stopped for carrying a backpack.
John, if I remember right, this match happened on the 29th of March. And the day before, that Monday, a train going from Abuja to Kaduna was attacked. The railway was bombed and at least 8 people were killed by terrorists. So this match, which happened the day after that attack, you mean to tell me that you were just able to walk right into the stadium?
Yes. And I would have expected increased security, but no, I just walked in. There were security operatives around, but no one checked anything on me, and I didn't see them checking anyone else around me.
Okay, John, so what happened after you got in?
So I got a seat, and it wasn't long before Nigeria scored a goal, so the score was equalized at 1-1. The crowd around me went wild, just celebrating. I was happy too, but I had to keep my hands in my pockets the whole time because there were people going around picking pockets everywhere. I mean, little kids even were picking pockets. So again, not really the relaxing evening I was hoping for. But I stayed through the final whistle, and you know how it ended. Nigeria lost. Which meant we were disqualified from the World Cup. The fans, they were not happy. So as soon as that whistle blew, I started seeing empty water bottles just flying through the air. People were throwing their water bottles onto the football pitch. I knew it was time to get out of there. And as I was making my way out, I saw another section of the crowd trying to rip off the fence that separated the stadium seats from the football pitch. I think they wanted to go after the players, but by then the players had already left the field. The crowd, which by this time really became more of a mob, was out to destroy anything they could get their hands on. They started to destroy the benches, the nets, just anything they could get their hands on. This whole thing and how it ended really bothered me. And I started to wonder, why did this kind of thing happen anyway? I asked around to get some other people's opinions.
Laws are as effective as the people who enforce them. So if the laws are there and I tell you, we don't have a paucity of laws. There are a lot of laws in Nigeria, and good laws at that. But the problem is, how do we enforce these laws?
Why do you think when we go to foreign countries, we behave? We have this mindset that if you don't behave, they have a law, there are people to enact it, and nobody is compromising, irrespective of your status.
I think making the punishment immediate after being caught is the best thing to, you know, limit this kind of thing from happening again. So that whatever be the case, your anger should not be the reason for vandalizing and engaging in any form of violence.
Several people kept bringing up the idea that the mob behaved the way they did because they knew they wouldn't get caught. Basically, that there was nothing there to deter the mob from destroying the stadium.
But John, it's a stadium. What kind of deterrence do we need to have in a stadium? I mean, do we need to pack the place with police officers?
Well, if we look at the behavior of the people in other countries, it's clear that deterrence is not always about having police around. People will generally do bad things or things that are considered bad if they think they can get away with it. In all of the academic studies about deterrence, there are usually 3 factors that need to be in place in order to deter criminal or antisocial activity. The first is the certainty of being caught. The second is the severity of the punishment. And the third is the immediacy of the judicial system. How quickly could that punishment happen? But I actually think there's one even more critical factor, and that's the factor of conformity. People tend to behave in a way that is consistent with their environment. Think about it this way. You're walking down a very clean, well-groomed street, and maybe you're holding a bottle of Coke you just finished drinking. You probably will not drop that bottle on the ground because in the context of that very clean street, your behavior would be inconsistent. Even if you do throw the bottle on the ground, somehow you feel that your behavior is out of place.
But if you take the same bottle and the same person and you put them on a street that's littered with trash...
Exactly. That same person will more likely feel that it's okay to throw that bottle on the ground. Even though that behavior is considered to be littering, it's still antisocial. But in the context of the dirty street, the person will feel justified. So conformity can actually be a very strong deterrent to criminal or antisocial behavior. And conformity can help encourage pro-social behaviors too. Take the example of what happened after the 2018 World Cup match between Japan and Colombia. Japan won that match 2-1, and they could have just walked away to celebrate. Instead, the fans stayed back and cleaned up after themselves. The world was just amazed by this. But it didn't just happen that one time after they won. A few weeks later, they lost to Belgium 3-2, and they still waited around to clean up their trash. And it wasn't just one Japanese fan. All of the Japanese fans participated in the cleanup. They conformed to that behavior.
So, John, are we saying that the destruction of the MKO Abiola Stadium after last month's match, that we could have actually prevented that if some people started cleaning up instead of destroying it?
Possibly, but only if you get a critical mass of people so that the vandals feel out of place. If you only had one or two or even 100 people cleaning, it would not have made a difference. Everyone would have had to start cleaning in order for the vandalists to realize that their behavior looked out of place. But the problem was that their behavior did not look or feel out of place to them. Yes, it was illegal and many of them knew that, but in the context of the environment, they were conforming. Trash from the 90 minutes of the game had been allowed to just build up and stay on the floor and even near the pitch. So to them, adding more trash just fit into the context. The very fact that some of them were even allowed to enter the stadium without any security checks or a valid ticket gave them even more permission to conform to the environment. So when a critical mass of mostly young men started to vandalize the stadium, it's not surprising that others confirmed.
So, John, how do we prevent this? I mean, it would be wonderful if we had a culture like Japan where everyone cleans up after themselves. But right now, we don't. So what do we do to stop things like this from happening?
Police presence would help, but honestly, we don't have enough police to put on every street in Nigeria. And we definitely can't spare them to be monitoring every football game. We need them to focus on bandits. But there are really simple things that could have been done to limit what happened. First, only ticket holders should have been allowed to enter that stadium. Then they should have checked every bag packed entering that stadium and turned away anyone carrying anything that could have been used as a weapon or anyone bringing in their own water bottles. If you don't want to turn them away, then make them throw those things out before entering. Doing this would have at least set the expectation that certain behaviors would not be tolerated. Another thing that could have been done is to have hired people to be cleaning the stadium as the game was going on. But that would have worked only if they limited the number of people in the stadium to 60,000. If people saw the stadium being cleaned as the game was going on, they are more likely to feel out of place if they then start to trash it. None of this is 100% going to prevent vandalism, but it will reduce it. The point is that if we all conform to make the environment clean and secure, vendors and maybe even bandits will feel out of place.
John, is there a price to conformity?
Numbers are really important when it comes to using conformity as a deterrent to criminal behavior. The group that is conforming has to be large and they have to know that they are large. So, for example, Layan Mohammed has been asking people to come out and tell government whatever information they have on banditry and terrorism. But people are not complying. That's because they don't feel safe. Maybe they feel like they are the only ones giving information and that makes them a target for bandits and terrorists. But what if they knew that there are hundreds and maybe even thousands of other people who were providing information? What if they knew that together they could be a big force strong enough to take on the bandits and that there is safety in numbers?
The Backstory is a Triple E Media production. Production copyright 2022 Triple E Media Productions. If you enjoyed this episode of The Backstory and you would like to hear more, go to our website at 234audio.com to play the sample content. Then download our app from the Google Play Store for even more episodes. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel at 234audio to watch the video for this episode. Make sure to click the notification bell, like, and leave a comment. Our episodes can also be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe, like, and leave a comment. This episode of The Backstory was produced by Ramat Mohammed, Usama Lucky, John Iwoji, Uche Mba, Dominic Tabakaji, and Sam Tabakaji. Executive producer Ramat Mohammed. Special thanks to Mala Iwa Badu Ikaleku. A special thank you to everyone who took the time to share your thoughts with us. Your contributions are very much appreciated. I'm Ramat Mohammed. See you next week.